Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of September 23rd, 2011. This week, the Fed announced it is pushing down long-term interest rates. One of the side effects is it could get even easier to refinance, maybe even buy a new home with super low interest rates. But there is one not-so-small problem.
People aren't buying partly because they're scared to buy in this shaky economy, or they just can't get a loan no matter how low the interest rate is.
And got a beef with your credit score? You'll have to get in line behind this guy.
I'm in the best financial position I've been in my whole life now, and I have like the lowest credit score. When I had my highest score, I had tons of debt. I just assumed credit scores were a number you could put on someone that would somehow reflect their ability to pay.
Plus, the high demand for used cars could mean money in your pocket if you're selling.
I mean, let's face it, the country is still in an economizing frame of mind, and that's definitely driven the prices up.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
This week, the Federal Reserve offered its latest stab at fixing the economy. Supporters described it as a life raft. Detractors say it's more like swim floaties. You may have heard the name. It's called Operation Twist. Harks back to a previous Fed move in the 1960s, when it was also, of course, a dance craze. Now it might refer to people twisting their faces in aggravation. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to join us from our Washington Bureau for some perspective. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Tess.
Let's talk about what exactly the Fed has done here. What is Operation Twist?
Yeah, it's a nice catchy name for Fed monetary policy,
right?
which is a nice change. The Fed is going to rearrange its portfolio. It's going to sell short-term Treasury bonds and buy up long-term bonds. And the idea here is to push down long-term rates.
And by long-term, we're talking the 10-year T-note?
Yeah, 10-year Treasury note, and that actually even the 30-year, and that will hopefully be followed by things like mortgage rates and long-term loans for small businesses.
Right. Well, why would the Fed want to do this? Who are they aiming it at specifically?
The Fed is aiming at job creators, targeting big investors like hedge funds, also corporations. The Fed is hoping they'll move away from investments in long-term bonds because the rate of return is so low, instead plowing their money into things that would create jobs, building a new mall, opening a new factory. Now, the Fed is also trying to help consumers here. They want to help us refinance our homes, maybe go out and buy a new house. And the thinking is consumers won't be able to resist super low mortgage rates.
But the fact is, interest rates are already at historic lows. I mean, we're looking at mortgages that are sub 4%, and people still aren't buying, right?
Exactly. And that's the problem. People aren't buying partly because they're scared to buy in this shaky economy. They think they might lose their job, or they just can't get a loan no matter how low the interest rate is. I talked with Ken Kuttner about this. He's a former Fed economist now at Williams College.
Lenders have really become more conservative and retrenched in terms of their lending behavior. And yes, well, on the margin, a slightly lower interest rate will help. It's really going to be a pretty small effect, I think, overall in the economy.
And Tess, I asked Kuttner about the overall impact on other types of consumer loans, like rates on credit cards and car loans,
yeah,
for example. He really didn't see much of a change there. He says the Fed just isn't aiming at those rates. It's working more on rates for long-term loans, like I said, things like mortgages. So really, Tess, Operation Twist isn't much to shout about.
Very nicely done.
You knew I was going to use that
one. Yeah, you were going to get there eventually. Well, anything that has an upside for some people most likely has a downside for others.
Yeah, some consumers could actually be hurt by what the Fed's done. Long-term savers, for example. Tess, have you checked out CD rates lately?
No, I haven't bothered.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're just so low. It's
right.
Just it's not worth it. And now they're going to be lower still. Also, your rate of return on a bond market mutual fund is going to fall.
Yeah.
And of course, your 401k isn't going to get much of a boost. The market fell like a rock after the Fed announcement. One thing that's kind of ironic here, Tess, Kuttner says one reason Operation Twist won't have the impact the Fed is hoping for is demand. There's so little consumer demand out there. We are part of the problem. Investors aren't going to build a new mall right now, no matter how low interest rates are, because no one's out shopping. So, Tess, we need to go out and shop. Force yourself.
Well, I suppose I could do my part on that score, but of course I will not be using a credit card.
No, ma'am.
No, ma'am. All right. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joining us from our Washington Bureau. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So as Nancy mentioned, it is a great time to get a mortgage, assuming you can find a bank that's actually lending money. But before they do that, they will require an appraisal of the property. Same if you're doing a refi. They'll visit the house and they'll look at what are called comps, comparable homes that have sold in your area. But the high number of foreclosures is complicating that math, because foreclosures can also be used as comps. Joe Magziars is president of the Appraisal Institute.
Foreclosure sales should only be used as a last resort by appraisers.
But from what we're hearing, foreclosures are factoring in. Is there a certain point at which they should be calculated?
For example, in the Las Vegas market where there are so many foreclosures, they might be the only sales occurring.
So you don't really have any other so-called comps?
That may be the case, but hopefully that's in rare circumstances.
Are there other markets where you're seeing that that is necessary?
Well, there have been some in Florida where they have a huge oversupply of condominiums and a lot of foreclosures. But in some markets, usually there's a number of market transactions that should be utilized.
Does that mean that, as a general rule, unless you're in a place like Las Vegas or Florida, that foreclosures should not be calculated when appraisers are out looking at your home's value?
An appraiser must consider all the sales in the marketplace and look for the ratio of conventional sales versus foreclosure sales.
Then explain to us why a property owner, perhaps in a nice neighborhood, thinking that their home has a certain value, would then have to be subjected to the fact that maybe a bank has been holding on to a foreclosure for a long time, really due to, it's not the homeowner's fault at all that foreclosure is sitting in their neighborhood.
You're correct. It's not their fault. And in some markets, the marketing time to sell these foreclosures is greatly extended. And that's very unfortunate. Well, when we had that situation before in the savings and loan days back in the late 80s and 90s, that oversupply was sold off rather quickly. So we're not experiencing the terrible decline in values that you see today.
How much of an effect, then, would a foreclosure have on a home value, perhaps within a block or two or within a neighborhood?
You have to look at the ratio of homes that are selling normally in that market, and then you should concentrate on those sales as being reflective of market value. If one had to use a foreclosure sale, it would require probably a significant upward adjustment to bring it to a value conclusion similar to that would happen under a normal market sale.
How does a homeowner make sure that they're getting a fair appraisal?
Well, unfortunately, the regulations for federally related transactions, this would be a loan through a bank. The lender must select the appraiser, or they use a management company or another fiduciary to select that appraiser. So the homeowner really doesn't get to choose the appraiser. One of the things they could do is request someone from that immediate area. And if they have a chance to talk to the appraiser, they should ask them how active they are in that area when they're making an appointment. If they find out they're 50 miles away, I would probably tell that person not to come and call that lender and tell them to get somebody local, because right now it's really important that you understand that market. And that market could be a very small area. You wouldn't send someone from Chicago out here to DeKalb to appraise a home.
All right. Joe Magziars is the president of the Appraisal Institute. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So there are all kinds of factors keeping Americans from plunging into the housing market. They keep waiting for interest rates to drop even more. They wait for home prices to hit bottom, though no one is going to be able to pinpoint that until after the fact. Banks are being either exceedingly prudent or stingy about lending money for mortgages. But there is one thing all these factors fail to take into account, and that is history. Anyone with a longer than, say, one or two decade perspective on the housing market sees the situation in a completely different light. Marketplace Economics editor Chris Farrell knows one of those people.
Lately, I've gathered a lot of material on the housing market. It's striking how the market seems more attractive than the conventional gloom suggests. Sure, prices might go still lower. I know there are the deadweight forces of foreclosures and underwater mortgages. But we haven't seen mortgage rates this low for the last 40 years. Home prices seem to have stabilized in recent months. Rents are on the upswing, a traditional sign that buying is becoming more attractive. The other day, I talked over the phone to my 87-year-old mom. She and my late dad moved a lot over the years. Dad was in the military and then shipping. They sold their last house a little over a decade ago and moved into an apartment. "I wish I were 10 years younger," she said. I muttered something empathetic, a typical son thing about the passage of time. She brushed off my sentimentality. "No," she said. "If I were 10 years younger, I'd buy a home. Now, look at these house prices and mortgage rates." Here's the thing. Buying a home is an incredibly optimistic investment, a financial bet that tomorrow will be better than today. Of course, sometimes we get carried away, like during the housing bubble. Even so, without an optimistic turn of mind, who'd ever take out a 30-year mortgage? I don't know what my economic circumstances will be a year from now, let alone in 30 years' time. My parents bought their first home 62 years ago. They moved from a ratty apartment in Queens to Levittown, Long Island. My grandfather was furious. He had lost his home to foreclosure during the Great Depression and never bought again. He was angry because these two young adults with children were taking on far too much risk. That was the lesson of the Great Depression, right? Once I asked my mom why she and dad had bought. She said it was because they, and all their friends, believed the world was going to become a better place. That was it, and they took out a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Now, I don't know when the housing market will revive, but I do know this. If my mom were 10 years younger, she'd get a hell of a deal on a home. I just wish more politicians stoking anger and more CEOs sitting on record amounts of cash had just a sliver of her energy, her hope for the future.
Marketplace's Chris Farrell. We'd like your thoughts on why the housing market has yet to recover. Share them at marketplace.org/money. Last year, we brought you the story of a young couple in Dublin who were part of Ireland's new lost generation. Saddled with a hefty mortgage, a car loan, credit cards, they were left buried in debt after Ireland's housing bubble went bust in 2008. Well, there's a plan underway in Ireland to help those like them, and it's called bankruptcy reform. Christopher Worth has our story.
When I last spoke with Geraldine and Paul Mangan-Ebbs, I visited them here at their three-bedroom house an hour outside Dublin.
This is the office come spare bedroom.
Back then, they owed about $300,000 on the place. And at the time, they were worried about the future of Paul's job working construction, as new projects in that industry were cut back.
There will be no new residential or commercial building in Ireland, though.
Fast forward to today, and Paul has lost that job. But he does have a new one. So Geraldine and I meet up with him at this parking lot, just around the corner from his workplace.
Hey, Paul.
He's working the night shift, part-time, at a postal sorting facility. And as we pile into Geraldine's car to get out of the rain, he says he's earning just a third of the money he used to. That makes it hard to stay on top of the monthly mortgage payments and other debts.
But we're still paying our bills.
It's more about, like, how are we going to feed ourselves?
And in a country of only 4.5 million people, there are hundreds of thousands in Ireland like Geraldine and Paul, says Jill Kirby, a personal finance columnist for Ireland's Sunday Times newspaper.
We've built up a problem here of just biblical proportions. The total amount of personal debt in this country is about 250 billion euros. And there is simply no way that we can repay that level of debt.
250 billion euros is about $350 billion. And those high levels of indebtedness are why she says you'd expect to see a growing number of borrowers declaring bankruptcy in Ireland. But Warren Baxter of the financial consultancy Deloitte says last year, the year Ireland received a bailout from the European Union and International Monetary Fund, there were a mere 30 bankruptcies in the entire country.
People don't want to go down the bankruptcy route because bankruptcy in Ireland is a very harsh way to deal with your problems.
He says that's because once someone in Ireland goes into bankruptcy, the laws are so onerous it's practically impossible to get out.
And so they simply just remain in bankruptcy until they die.
As a result, Baxter says, there's a backlog of people in Ireland who, if they were in the States, might choose bankruptcy. But here, they're still weighed down with debts they can't pay. And he says that's causing a drag on the economy. But one of the conditions of Ireland's bailout is that the government has to make going bankrupt and getting out of bankruptcy a lot easier.
What the IMF and the EU are hoping to achieve is to use this as a method of helping get the Irish economy kickstarted, to give people a second chance.
People like Geraldine and Paul. New bankruptcy laws are expected in Ireland next year. So I ask if bankruptcy might be an option they'd consider.
I never thought of that, of bankruptcy, but it's only to be a last resort if I couldn't pay my bills.
If it was rock bottom.
You know, I took the loan out, so I want to pay my loan.
That is, if they can. Next year's bankruptcy reforms are expected to spark a wave of new bankruptcies and debt settlements in Ireland. The question is whether Ireland's already struggling banks can really afford to write down all of that debt. In Dublin, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace Money.
All right, it is that time in the show where we take your money questions. With me this very week is actor, dancer, Los Angeles Times consumer columnist, David Lazarus. Hi, David.
You left out Bon Vivant.
Well, I need not say that.
Okay, or Boulevardier. All the various gnomes de plume that I use.
You can do a little plié for me, please?
Not on the radio. No, on the radio I can get away with it as much as I want, actually. It's Black Swan for all everybody knows.
So this week, everybody talking about the Buffett rule.
Mm.
President came out earlier this week and basically said rich people need to pay more. Rich people like my friend Warren Buffett. And if we don't do that, we're never going to get ourselves out of this mess. Republicans immediately came back with class warfare.
Yes. Our conservative friends clearly think that it is because they see this as an assault on quote unquote job creators out there.
Right. I do want to, however, quote a tweet that I saw earlier this week that said the job creators should be fired because they're not creating very many jobs.
Well, and there it is, Tess. I mean, all that talk about job creators, I'd like to see the proof in the pudding there. I mean, first of all, we have record low or near record low corporate tax rates at the moment. Moreover, the Bush tax cuts cut the tax load of the wealthy to the tune of about $3 trillion,
mm-hmm.
and yet we now have a national unemployment rate near 10%. So indeed, those job creators seem to have like taken a little vacation because all of that empirical evidence should say that we should be dripping in jobs. And
that's,
we're not.
That's where the president said this is just math.
Exactly. And I thought that was a very wise riposte to the class warfare thing. And his point is, if you look at things on a percentage basis, he says, the rich just aren't paying their fair share. For example, Social Security, because there's a cap on how much the wealthy will pay, up to a little over $100,000 of your income, and it stops there. Meaning that Warren Buffett pays far less on a percentage basis into Social Security than his secretary does.
Right.
That's one of his key points here. And then when you factor in all of those tax shelters and loopholes and the lower rates for capital gains, it turns out that the wealthy are indeed paying on an aggregate basis less than people in the middle class. And what the president is saying is, it's not fair. And it's not. Does that get us entirely out of the hole? No,
no,
it does not. But if we're going to start talking about a fair system under which everybody pulls their weight, well, the president sounds like he's on the right track there.
Do you see progress on anything coming down the pike?
At the moment, no. Clearly, our political state is so divisive right now that left and right simply cannot find the common ground they need, even just to sit down and order from the same menu.
Well, if they can't order off the same menu, perhaps we should send them all to a buffet.
Ah, there you go. Or a buffet.
Or a buffet.
Oh! Bada bing.
All right. Well, let's go to our menu of callers.
Let's.
All right. And Tracy and Randy from Houston, Texas are with us. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
So we have you on the line at the same time. To what do we owe this pleasure?
Well, I had called in to talk to you guys. My husband has unfortunately been restructured.
Oh, boy.
Is that code for laid off?
That is code. That's what I was about to say. That's
okay.
A nice way to say it.
Hello. When was this?
This was in May.
This year?
Yeah.
Okay. What were you doing, Randy?
I was sales for Canon USA.
How long have you been with them?
For just over 8 years.
All right. So presumably you've been getting the resume out there, pounding the pavement, et cetera.
Multiple times every day.
Yeah.
So what's your plan?
Well, you know, first and foremost, find a job. But, you know, when I was with Canon, I kind of got into my comfort zone and didn't really even think about looking outside of Canon. And now, you know, I've been kind of exploring different opportunities. And one of the things that we've talked about is a franchise.
Oh, interesting.
And not getting any younger.
Any particular franchises you have your eye on?
We've spoken about
mini storage.
Oh, storage units?
Yeah.
So, Tracy, how do you feel about the whole franchise plan?
It does two things. Number one, it makes me nervous. My whole experience with the workforce, so to speak, has been you get up at 8, you go to work, you come home, you get a paycheck, it's the same thing. And now I'm nervous. You don't know what type of income, if and when it's going to come. And number two, there's a lot of scams, bogus opportunities, things like that, and I don't want us to get caught in that trap either.
Absolutely, and that's very wise of you to be keeping an eye out for that, because that's just rampant these days, David.
Yeah, I think Tracy's definitely being prudent here. Now, props to both of them, because it's great that Randy is thinking out of the box. He doesn't necessarily see another corporate gig falling into his lap, so he's trying to be proactive.
Well, and I think that's what a lot of folks are trying to do. You know, jobs so hard to come by that, well, maybe you can just create your own business, but is franchising a good option?
Well, and that's the thing. And with a franchise, the idea is you're going to hit the ground running because you're buying into an established enterprise
right. And
hopefully an established customer base. But as Tess was just saying, there are a lot of pitfalls on the franchising front. So here's what you got to look out for. When it comes to franchising, do your due diligence. Any franchisor is going to charge fees, and those fees can be onerous if you're not careful. So you want to find out how much those are. You always want to look for how much support you're going to get from the company. You know, will they give you marketing support, for example? Will there be an advertising budget? I mean, those are all good questions.
Are there any rooms for negotiating generally within these franchises?
I'd say the smaller the franchising operation, the more wiggle room there's going to be. But then again, the smaller ones are the ones where you're more likely to get bit by fly-by-nighters. So you want to tread carefully. Now, if you're going for a larger operation, like, say, a 7-Eleven or a McDonald's or something like that, you know pretty much what you're getting into, and there's going to be no wiggle room whatsoever.
So why is public storage kind of, I guess, the passion that you would be looking to get into?
A gentleman that I worked with has a number of those properties, and he's been tremendously happy. But then as well, one of the key factors in any decision has got to be how that particular franchise is able to withstand market forces within the economy. That is one franchise that I know of that is not immune, but much better able to withstand downfalls within the economy than other sectors.
All right, but Randy, game it through now. The reason that the storage business is doing so well is because people are down on their luck, and they're either closing the store, they're closing their home, they're doing whatever. They need a place to put their stuff. So the boom times for storage are a reflection of the miserable economy that you're citing. At some point, the economy starts turning around. So you will find that the storage industry is a cyclical industry that has its booms during our bad times and then kind of contracts a bit during the good times. And so you want to think it through.
Now, I have seen, or he has seen some emails come through with groups offering to meet with him to go through and match up with franchises. Are those, you feel, pretty much scams?
It really depends. You know, basically, if they're going to charge a fee, be wary of it. If it's
okay,
some kind of support group, then okay, you know, that's cool. I'm sure there's a gazillion forums on the internet of people who'll be more than happy to field questions online and offer support. Be real straight with them. Don't pretend you're some kind of industrial spy or anything. Just call up and say, I'm interested in getting into this line of work. I'm doing my homework. They'll answer them, because if they were smart, they did the same things that you're
exactly
doing.
Exactly.
That's true, definitely. Okay. Okay. Guess you've got some homework to do there, Randy.
I think we both got some homework to do.
Yeah, your schedule's a little bit lighter than mine, so.
All right. Hey, keep us up to date and let us know what you end up doing, would you?
Sure.
Definitely.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, we're going next to Gina, and she is in Chi-Town, Chicago. Hi, Gina.
Hi.
Well, what do you do there?
Well, actually, I get hired for a living. I've been with
wait,
the...
Wait, whoa, time out, time out.
Okay, well, let me clear that up. I'm a flight attendant.
Oh, very good. Very high for a living, why I oughta...
Well, did you go anywhere fun recently?
Yes, I had about a month off, and I spent a week in Argentina, and I...
One of my favorite places on earth.
I agree. Is it because the dollar's 4-1 there?
Well, that certainly helps.
Yes, it does.
You live like a king as an American in Argentina.
Yeah.
I will tell you that. I cannot recommend Argentina enough. I preach the gospel of that place, both Buenos Aires and I think everyone should be able to get to Patagonia before they die.
Right. And you've never had a steak until you've been to Argentina.
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yes. With a beautiful glass of Malbec.
Yes. Okay. That's why I'm broke. I fly a lot, and I end up spending money because I'm just different places, and I have a hard time buzzing myself together. And then I was in China, and, you know, China's like, oh, might as well buy it here because it's going to come from here anyway.
Well, it sounds like you have a spending problem when you go on vacation is what it is.
I have a spending problem when I go, period, when I'm on vacation, when I go out the house. But I'm getting to the age where I've got to get serious about this money thing.
Well, what's your income like? Is your income nice and steady to accommodate all that spending?
No. We're paid twice a month, and then all of the little extra stuff shows up on the second check. But if you don't do the longer trips, the international or something, you don't get all that little extra money.
Okay, so you do have a steady income, but the payments that you're receiving fluctuate based on where you've gone, how much overtime you've done, that sort of thing?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
This is a question that we get every once in a while from people who don't necessarily have the same paycheck, you know, month in, month out. And that does make it a little difficult to put together a budget.
It does, but it's not impossible.
Never impossible.
Never. And Gina, have you tried to budget based on the little roller coaster ride that is your paycheck?
I did at one time.
How'd that go?
Well, I'm calling you all to say that.
It didn't go very well.
It hasn't gone. I just was thinking that when I called you all that maybe we could look at a real sensible plan.
Okay, what I'm going to say right out of the gate is, do you, for instance, have your paychecks direct deposit into the bank?
Yes, I do.
I think this calls for you to try perhaps one of the online budgeting tools. Mint.com is a very popular one.
BudgetTracker.com.
BudgetTracker.com.
BudgetTracker.
Basically, what that allows you to do is track all of your expenses to see where those are going. And it also helps you see over time what your average income is. And I would say that you probably want to establish a baseline that does not include some of that extra money that you're getting.
Yeah,
so that you're really living on the very base of what your income is, and everything else then becomes gravy.
Also, if you're going to use some of those online tools, they'll be helpful in this regard, but also carry a little journal around with you
mm-hmm.
where you can list all of your expenses, just all of them, and then you sit down like one Sunday afternoon and you run down the list, and I'll bet you'll find you'll go, boy, I didn't need that. I didn't need that. Spent too much for this. And it'll give you a better sense of the patterns.
All right.
All right, Gina. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. Y'all happy travels. See you too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's all the time we've got for your questions. If you've got one of your own, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or shoot us a note. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and type in Getting Personal in the search box. David, thanks so much for stopping by.
It's always a pleasure.
And do remember to always talk to your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
Hi, I'm Alan Mosley. I live in Jersey City, New Jersey.
The thing that I pulled out of my wallet is an emergency contact card. It's a laminated card. It's got a list of names and phone numbers, starting with our Senior Director of Global Safety and Security. I'm a program officer with the International Rescue Committee, a humanitarian relief and development agency. So we provide relief assistance to people affected by disasters and emergencies. I cover Thailand, Myanmar, Kyrgyzstan, Iraq. I've never had to use my card, luckily, no. You know, I've been on the other end of a situation that was dicey, where I was the person getting some of those phone calls. That was a very complicated situation. I guess they always are. I haven't really talked about it with my family. I suppose they'd be happy to know that I have such a card. They understand where I'm going and the things that the IRC does. But at the same time, they're probably happier if I'm traveling to Boston, Massachusetts, than to some other places.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. About a month ago, the prominent blogger and MetaFilter founder, Matt Howey, took to his blog to vent about his declining credit score. The title of the post was, "Credit Scores Are Bull..." Well, we'll leave it there. He outlined his credit history and pointed out his score was higher when he carried more debt and was dropping as he seemingly became a more responsible financial citizen. The blogosphere lit up, the New York Times featured the debate, and John Oldsheimer of SmartCredit.com responded online. Well, we thought Matt's post highlighted several things that we find ridiculous about credit scores, so I've got both gentlemen with me to hash it out. Matt, John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Matt, let's start off with the blog post. Tell us what your current credit score is and what your beef is with that score.
My current credit score is 690, and I guess my beef is, I'm in the best financial position I've been in my whole life now, and I have, the lowest credit score I've had in years. And when I had my highest score, I had tons of debt. I'd just been paying the minimums on lots of credit cards, and I had a great credit score. I just assumed credit scores, were a number you could put on someone, and that would somehow reflect their ability to pay.
Okay. Are there any aspects of your finances that you do not share in this post that would give us some insight into your score?
Well, I guess I told John that I had one late payment 5 years ago, and that knocked me down 20-30 points.
What, on a credit card?
No, it was I was auto paying my mortgage, online, and there was some weird $30 charge that they wouldn't allow me to pay online, and so it basically never showed up in my email as a bill until suddenly we got a paper bill saying, hey, this thing is 2 months past due. And that was almost 5 years ago, and I did come down 30 points or something from that. But since then, I've dropped almost 100 more. Mostly, it's not having credit cards, and I think that's a good thing. I just buy everything with my ATM Visa mm-hmm. card, with real cash, and that's not good in the credit score world.
All right, John, let's get to you. Your first note to Matt was essentially that what he was looking at was not his FICO score, correct?
Yeah. We identified issue number one, which mm-hmm. is that all of the advice that Matt was given was being given to improve a credit score that, A, has zero relevance in the world of financial services. No lender uses it. No insurance company uses it.
But John, I followed your advice to try myfico.com, and it mm-hmm. was only 2 points off.
What Matt's referring to is we actually communicated through his blog, and I suggested that he kind of get off the freecreditreport.com track and get on the FICO track,
right?
Which would at least put him in the environment where the score that he's seeing would be relevant information that perhaps a bank that he would want to do business with in the future would be able to see. So the fact that the scores were similar is really immaterial. What is material is that no one item on your credit report drives your score to be whatever it is. But the primary factor in your credit score is going to be, are you paying your bills on time and what kind of debt you're in? Now, don't get me wrong, Matt. If they screwed you by not giving you proper notice that you couldn't pay that $30 fee online, I'm in your corner. The problem when you look at a credit report is that there's no backstory. There's no way for a credit scoring system to look at a credit report and say, hey, look, this is a billing snafu. These delinquencies should not be considered in anybody's score. There's no way for them to distinguish between a valid and an invalid late payment.
Yeah, but John, from what Matt told us, that was 5 years ago. But his credit score has been falling more recently. So why would something that happened 5 years ago suddenly start to show up as a problem for him?
Well, we don't know that that's actually occurred because we don't know what his FICO score was 5 years ago when this all started.
So then if that's the case, Matt, do you still feel comfortable saying some of the things that you said on your blog? Given that you weren't looking at the most common and most utilized score, which is the FICO score.
Well, I mean, even when I did, you know, I've got a 2-point difference out of 700. So I assume it's a very accurate estimation.
Let me jump in here. Let's take one example. Matt's complaint that his score went down when he closed cards. And John, you talked about in your response the fact that it was because his utilization went up when he closed cards. He was using more of the credit limit on fewer cards. In essence, the system punishes you for shedding cards and closing accounts.
Closing a card does not have any influence at all over the length of credit history. A card that's open that's 10 years old is just as old as a card that's closed that's 10 years old. That's actually a pretty common myth in credit scoring. But the first part of what you said is absolutely true. If you do close cards and you're carrying balances on other cards that are still open, you're reducing the amount of what's called open to buy or the aggregate amount of your credit limits.
But then basically, again, that is an argument for having more cards.
I would suggest that it's an argument to not have credit card debt than it is to have open card.
But if you have no credit cards, your score is going to go down.
Absolutely not. If you have no credit cards, then you have no credit card debt. And your score is absolutely fine, assuming that you're doing the other things good, like paying your bills on time.
Okay. I've been told again and again and again I shouldn't have closed my credit cards. You know, it starts to feel like a part-time job to nurse this score. It's a ridiculous amount of work.
What he's saying is absolutely true. Here's the deal. Credit scoring is a complicated and sometimes infuriating and maddening machine. And I'm the first to say that is absolutely the case. But I would say that to simply suggest that they're unfair and we'd be better off without them and that some stuff doesn't make common sense, I think that's being a little bit short-sighted. In the next 15 seconds, I will explain how to have fantastic FICO scores forever. Pay all of your bills on time. Don't ever give anybody an excuse to say something bad about you to a credit reporting agency like delinquencies or collections. If you choose to use credit cards, maintain as low of a balance as you possibly can relative to the credit limit. Shop for credit only when you need credit, not to get the discount at the mall during Christmas time. And as your credit report gets older, just organically, and as you build a more diverse set of accounts on your credit report, you will earn and maintain very, very good scores. That's it.
So, Matt, has this changed your mind at all?
Not really. I understand everything John has said. I mean, the core issue is I've watched my score go gently down over the last couple of years.
Although it was not your FICO score.
Right, but I think it's a close estimate. I've watched it go down by just practicing good financial habits, by using cash instead of credit, you know, pouring all my money into retirement. I know these are things that have nothing to do with credit, and I know they have no access to my account. So the credit stuff is just going to be an estimate based on my activity.
All right. It has been an interesting conversation. Thank you both for joining us. Matt Howie is a longtime blogger, founder of metafilter.com. Thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
And John Oldtimer is president of consumer education at smartcredit.com. Thank you as well.
Thanks for having me, Tess.
And we do have a link to Matt's original blog post at marketplace.org. Buying local is trendy these days, really trendy. And it's not just hipsters looking to score locally grown lemon oregano. People have all sorts of reasons for spending their food budget close to home. Support the local economy, help out the environment. Fewer miles traveled means less pollution, right? Well, it turns out, like so many things, it is complicated. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Pity the potato. It's a long haul from the soiled hands of the farm worker to the shiny, misty shelves at the grocery store. Food, like our potato, travels an average of 1,500 miles before it realizes its life purpose on the end of a fork. That's about the distance from Omaha to Los Angeles. And it's enough of a trek involving enough gas and pollution to get some people all worked up about food miles. Want to reduce that number? Try your local farmer's market.
Reset food!
I wanted to know how far these potatoes have traveled.
They have traveled around 110 miles, 115 miles.
And are they good travelers?
Yeah, they travel well.
Apparently, they don't fuss in the back seat. Alex Weiser runs Weiser Family Farms. He's got a table of beautiful heirloom potatoes.
I think people want food that's grown locally and is grown for flavor and has, you know, great nutritional value and doesn't put a lot of not wasting resources.
Kathleen Merrigan is the U.S. Deputy Secretary of Agriculture. She says there are all sorts of reasons farmers are good neighbors. Local farms help people eat better by making fresh, healthy food more available. And buying local can help support local economies.
All wonderful stuff.
Today, when it's so hard to figure out how to spend our food budget responsibly and ethically and sustainably, food miles can seem like an easy indicator. But it's not quite that simple. For one, food miles aren't the best way to judge how much pollution food is responsible for.
We know from our studies that the fuel use per unit of product delivered to consumers may be higher or lower.
Transportation only accounts for about 10% of the pollution created by the food we eat. And local doesn't say anything about how the food was grown. Just imagine the energy it takes to grow a tomato in the winter in a heated greenhouse.
If they're trying to minimize energy usage, there have been a number of studies that have shown that it's probably better to think about changing your diet than it is to think about buying local.
Chuck Nicholson is a professor at Cornell and Cal Poly. According to one study, cutting red meat and dairy out of your diet one day a week has the same environmental impact as eating local. Nicholson has studied the impact of reducing food miles in the dairy industry. Research, he says, that points to a broader issue with the local food movement.
Your local decisions can have effects on people farther away.
If you and I and our neighbor start buying local, whole systems of food production will be affected, which isn't always a good thing, especially if you're a farmer far away.
There are other issues to be concerned about in the sourcing of our food, including social justice.
Gawain Kripke is a policy director at Oxfam in Washington, D.C. His colleagues worked on an analysis of the global food market to show how dependent farmers in poorer countries are on the food dollars of developed countries. One tidbit from the study, UK food supply chains support 1 to 1.5 million farm workers in sub-Saharan Africa.
We don't want to exclude small food producers, for instance, in poor countries, just because they're distant from us. Because we're using this distance measure.
The basic idea is that if you buy your broccoli from your local farmer, you're not buying it at the grocery store, which means that the broccoli farmer in another part of the world that sells to your grocery store won't have a market for it and won't make a living. It's a bit of a conundrum. How do you feed yourself and your family in a way that's good for them and everybody else on the planet? According to the experts, it boils down to something like this. Buy fruits and veggies in season. Look for fair trade labels on international foods. Buy local when it makes sense. Waste less. And eat less meat. I feel like I always wind up saying that. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace Money.
Earlier this year, we did an entire show on car ownership. And when it came to the new versus used debate, Phil Reed of Edmunds.com made his case for team used.
If you wait one full year, you have 1 year's worth of depreciation and 1 year's worth of mileage. Not only that, but from there on in, that used car depreciates less than it did in that first year.
But fast forward a few months and the story has changed. The cost of used cars is at an all-time high. So Phil is back to explain. Good to see you again.
It's good to be here, Tess.
So if you remember, we were over at a car lot over in Santa Monica.
Sure.
It was a beautiful day.
Yes.
And we were talking about the value of used cars. And the argument was essentially that a two-year-old car is the sweet spot and that that's what folks should be aiming for.
Right.
But boy, have things changed in the last 4 or 5 months?
it looks like fall is shaping up to be really a turning point.
So tell us what's happening here.
Well, used car prices have gone way up, backing up a little bit. There was the earthquake in Japan and then and the tsunami. Mm-hmm. And as a result, not only were Japanese manufactured cars severely impacted, but also many manufacturers that manufactured parts for American cars were too. The net effect was that the inventories on the lots were severely reduced, basically.
For new cars, yeah.
This put a lot of pressure on the used car market because a lot of people turned to used cars. The prices of used cars began to really climb in a way that we had never seen them do before. And the line between new and used began to blur somewhat. There were times when you were really better off economically speaking, to buy a new car than a used car, because some of the used cars were so high in value, had held their value well over the year or two since they had been put into the market.
How unusual is that? Have we seen this before? Aside from, you know, maybe the Prius and other used cars that have really held their value.
Sure. The entire market for used cars, almost all of the classes, particularly though the lower, more economically based cars, did hold their value quite well. I mean, let's face it, the country is still in an economizing frame of mind.
Right.
And that's definitely driven the prices up.
So does this basically mean that used cars are not as cost-effective as buying a new car, or does it really depend on what kind of car you're looking at?
The market is so broad that there are still bargains to be had out there. And a lot of the noise about the used car prices are the experts. It's the auctions. It's the used car salesmen. Well, hopefully it's me too, because I did sell a used car this summer.
You did?
Yes,
you sold your Fit.
I sold my Honda Fit. I sold it for $11,500. The guy that bought it turned around and sold it for an additional $500 a couple of weeks later.
You must have felt like a sucker.
You know, I like to think that I sell things at the right price.
There you go.
You know, for me, the aggravation of an extra $500 wasn't worth it.
Yeah. So what does one do with this? If you've basically been taking the advice that we gave just a few months ago in our car show, which was really look for something that's 2 years old and you're going to hit the sweet spot. Is that out the window?
Not entirely. I'm not going to contradict my own expert advice. but 2 years old, you're probably pretty good. 1 year, you're in a position where, you know, it's so near new that you're competing with the new car value. Now, it appears that the market is recovering. The inventories are climbing. The recovery from the earthquake is really a little bit ahead of schedule. So what that means is that probably the used car prices are going to come down a little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah.
But you still may be looking at not a huge difference between the used car market and the new car market.
In some cases, they're going to be very close.
So still do all that comparison shopping that we've talked about before.
Yes. I mean,
always.
Whenever you're getting ready to buy something as big as an automobile, you definitely have to do the research because the market is fluctuating all of the time. And, you know, we have pricing guides like Edmunds.com, but you also have to look at the actual market, which would be used car classifieds. And again, these are asking prices. So when you actually get into the negotiation process, you have to keep that in mind.
All right. Phil Reed is the Senior Consumer Advice Editor at Edmunds.com. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And Phil weighs in on prepaid car maintenance on our Making Money blog at marketplace.org. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to North Olmsted, Ohio. I asked our friends on Facebook to submit piggy nominations this week. William Cohn posted that he and his family just made the final payment on $21,480 worth of credit card debt. It took 4.5 years, he wrote, but now they have their first zero balance statement on the refrigerator. Congratulations, Piggy is on his way. Meantime, folks, you should check out the rest of the submissions. Lots of really smart money moves. Plus the guy who's buying Greek yogurt to do his part for the European debt crisis. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. You can friend us, and me too, or subscribe to me on Facebook, and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Marketplace Money is produced by John Buckley with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.